Chapter 8. How the Brigadier bore himself at Waterloo. 1. The story of the Forest Inn. Of all the great battles in which I had the honor of drawing my sword for the Emperor and for France, there was not one which was lost. At Waterloo, although, in a sense, I was present, I was unable to fight, and the enemy was victorious. It is not for me to say that there is a connection between these two things. You know me too well, my friends, to imagine that I would make such a claim. But it gives matter for thought, and some have drawn flattering conclusions from it. After all, it was only a matter of breaking a few English squares, and the day would have been our own. If the hussars of Conflans, with Etienne Gerard to lead them, could not do this, then the best judges are mistaken. But let that pass. The fates had ordained that I should hold my hand, and that the empire should fall. But they had also ordained that this day of gloom and sorrow should bring such honor to me as had never come when I swept on the wings of victory from Bowlen to Vienna. Never had I burned so brilliantly as at that supreme moment when the darkness fell upon all around me. You are aware that I was faithful to the Emperor in his adversity, and that I refused to sell my sword and my honor to the Bourbons. Never again was I to feel my war horse between my knees, never again to hear the kettle drums and silver trumpets behind me as I rode in front of my little rascals. But it comforts my heart, my friends, and it brings the tears to my eyes, to think how great I was upon that last day of my soldier life, and to remember that of all the remarkable exploits which have won me the love of so many beautiful women, and the respect of so many noble men, there was none which, in splendor, in audacity, and in the great end which was attained, could compare with my famous ride upon the night of June 18, 1815. I am aware that the story is often told at mess tables and in barrack rooms, so that there are few in the army who have not heard it, but modesty has sealed my lips. Until now, my friends, in the privacy of these intimate gatherings, I am inclined to lay the true facts before you. In the first place, there is one thing which I can assure you. In all his career, Napoleon never had so splendid an army as that with which he took the field for that campaign. In 1813, France was exhausted. For every veteran there were 5 children, Marie-Louise, as we called them, for the Empress had busied herself in raising levies, while the Emperor took the field. But it was very different in 1815. The prisoners had all come back, the men from the snows of Russia, the men from the dungeons of Spain, the men from the hulks in England. These were the dangerous men, veterans of 20 battles, longing for their old trade, and with hearts filled with hatred and revenge. The ranks were full of soldiers who wore 2 and 3 chevrons, every chevron meaning 5 years' service. And the spirit of these men was terrible. They were raging, furious, fanatical, adoring the Emperor as a Mameluke does his prophet, ready to fall upon their own bayonets, if their blood could serve him. If you had seen these fierce old veterans going into battle, with their flushed faces, their savage eyes, their furious yells, you would wonder that anything could stand against them. So high was the spirit of France at that time, that every other spirit would have quailed before it. But these people, these English, had neither spirit nor soul, but only solid, immovable beef, against which we broke ourselves in vain. That was it, my friends. On the one side, poetry, gallantry, self-sacrifice, all that is beautiful and heroic. On the other side, beef. Our hopes, our ideals, our dreams, all were shattered on that terrible beef of old England. You have read how the Emperor gathered his forces, and then how he and I, with 130,000 veterans, hurried to the northern frontier and fell upon the Prussians and the English. On the 16th of June, Ney held the English in play at Quatre Bras, while we beat the Prussians at Ligny. It is not for me to say how far I contributed to that victory, but it is well known that the hussars of Conflans covered themselves with glory. They fought well, these Prussians, and 8,000 of them were left upon the field. The Emperor thought that he had done with them, as he sent Marshal Grouchy with 32,000 men to follow them up and to prevent their interfering with his plans. Then with nearly 80,000 men, he turned upon these autumn Englishmen. how much we had to avenge upon them, we Frenchmen, the guineas of Pitt, the oats of Portsmouth, the invasion of Wellington, the perfidious victories of Nelson. At last the day of punishment seemed to have arisen. Wellington had with him 67,000 men, but many of them were known to be Dutch and Belgian, who had no great desire to fight against us. Of good troops he had not 50,000. Finding himself in the presence of the Emperor in person with 80,000 men, this Englishman was so paralyzed with fear that he could neither move himself nor his army. You have seen the rabbit when the snake approaches. So stood the English upon the ridge of Waterloo. The night before, the Emperor, who had lost an aide-de-camp at Ligny, ordered me to join his staff, and I had left my hussars to the charge of Major Victor. I know not which of us was the most grieved, they or I, that I should be called away upon the eve of battle, but an order is an order, and a good soldier can but shrug his shoulders and obey. With the Emperor I rode across the front of the enemy's position on the morning of the 18th, he looking at them through his glass, and planning which was the shortest way to destroy them. Soult was at his elbow, and Ney and Foy and others who had fought the English in Portugal and Spain. Ave a care, sire, said Soult. The English infantry is very solid. You think them good soldiers, because they have beaten you, said the Emperor, and we younger men turned away our faces and smiled. But Ney and Foy were grave and serious. All the time the English line, checkered with red and blue and dotted with batteries, was drawn up silent and watchful within a long musket shot of us. On the other side of the shallow valley our own people, having finished their soup, were assembling for the battle. It had rained very heavily, but at this moment the sun shone out, and beat upon the French army, turning our brigades of cavalry into so many dazzling rivers of steel, and twinkling and sparkling on the innumerable bayonets of the infantry. At the sight of that splendid army, and the beauty and majesty of its appearance, I could contain myself no longer, but, rising in my stirrups, I waved my busby and cried, Vive l'Empereur! A shout which growled and roared and clattered from one end of the line to the other, while the horsemen waved their swords, and the footmen held up their shakos upon their bayonets. The English remained petrified upon their ridge. They knew that their hour had come. And so it would have come, if at that moment the word had been given, and the whole army had been permitted to advance. We had but to fall upon them, and to sweep them from the face of the earth. To put aside all question of courage, we were the more numerous, the older soldiers, and the better led. But the Emperor desired to do all things in order, and he waited until the ground should be drier and harder, so that his artillery could maneuver. So 3 hours were wasted, and it was 11 o'clock, before we saw Jerome de Lonaparte's columns advance upon our left, and heard the crash of the guns which told that the battle had begun. The loss of those 3 hours was our destruction. The attack upon the left was directed upon the farmhouse which was held by the English guards, and we heard the three loud shouts of apprehension which the defenders were compelled to utter. They were still holding out, and D'Erlon's corps was advancing upon the right to engage another portion of the English line, when our attention was called away from the battle beneath our noses to a distant portion of the field of action. The Emperor had been looking through his glass to the extreme left of the English line, and now he turned suddenly to the Duke of Dalmatia, or Soult, as we soldiers preferred to call him. What is it, Marshal? Said he. We all followed the direction of his gaze, some raising our glasses, some shading our eyes. There was a thick wood over yonder, then a long, bare slope, and another wood beyond. Over this bare strip between the two woods there lay something dark, like the shadow of a moving cloud. I think that they are cattle, sire, said Soult. At that instant there came a quick twinkle from amid the dark shadow. It is Grouchy, said the Emperor, and he lowered his glass. They are doubly lost, these English. I hold them in the hollow of my hand. They cannot escape me. He looked round, and his eyes fell upon me. Ah! Here is the Prince of Messengers, said he. Really well mounted, Colonel Gerard? I was riding my little Violette, the pride of the brigade. I said so. Then ride hard to Marshal Grouchy, whose troops you see over yonder. Tell him that he is to fall upon the left flank and rear of the English, while I attack them in front. Together we should crush them, and not a man escape. I saluted and rode off without a word, my heart dancing with joy that such a mission should be mine. I looked at that long, solid line of red and blue looming through the smoke of the guns, and I shook my fist at it as I went. He shall crush them, and not a man escape. They were the Emperor's words, and it was I, Etienne Gerard, who was to turn them into deeds. I burned to reach the Marshal, and for an instant I thought of riding through the English left wing, as being the shortest cut. I have done bolder deeds, and come out safely, but I reflected that, if things went badly with me, and I was taken or shot, the message would be lost, and the plans of the Emperor miscarry. I passed in front of the cavalry, therefore, past the chasseurs, the lancers of the guard, the carabineers, the horse grenadiers, and, lastly, my own little rascals, who followed me wistfully with their eyes. Beyond the cavalry, the old guard was standing, 12 regiments of them, all veterans of many battles, somber and severe, in long blue overcoats and high bearskins from which the plumes had been removed. Each bore within the goatskin knapsack upon his back the blue and white parade uniform which they would use for their entry into Brussels next day. As I rode past them, I reflected that these men had never been beaten, and as I looked at their weather-beaten faces, and their stern and silent bearing, I said to myself that they never would be beaten. Great heavens, how little could I foresee what a few more hours would bring! On the right of the old guard were the young guard and the 6th Corps of Laube, and then I passed Jacquinet's lancers and Marbot's hussars, who held the extreme flank of the line. All these troops knew nothing of the corps which was coming toward them through the wood, and their attention was taken up in watching the battle which raged upon their left. More than 100 guns were thundering from each side, and the din was so great that of all the battles which I have fought I cannot recall more than half a dozen which were as noisy. I looked back over my shoulder, and there were 2 brigades of cuirassiers, English and French, pouring down the hill together, with the sword blades playing over them like summer lightning. How I longed to turn violet, and to lead my hussars into the thick of it. What a picture! Etienne Gerard with his back to the battle, and a fine cavalry action raging behind him. But duty is duty, so I rode past Marbot's vedettes, and on in the direction of the wood, passing the village of Frischermond upon my left. In front of me lay the great wood, called the Wood of Paris, consisting mostly of oak trees, with a few narrow paths leading through it. I halted and listened when I reached it, but out of its gloomy depths there came no blare of trumpet, no murmur of wheels, no tramp of horses, to mark the advance of that great column which, with my own eyes, I had seen streaming toward it. The battle roared behind me, but in front all was as silent as that grave in which so many brave men would shortly sleep. The sunlight was cut off by the arches of leaves above my head, and a heavy damp smell rose from the sodden ground. For several miles I galloped at such a pace as few riders would care to go, with roots below and branches above. Then, at last, for the first time I caught a glimpse of Grouchy's advance guard. Scattered parties of hussars passed me on either side, but some distance off, among the trees. I heard the beating of a drum far away, and the low, dull murmur which an army makes upon the march. Any moment I might come upon the staff, and deliver my message to Grouchy in person, for I knew well that on such a march a marshal of France would certainly ride with the van of his army. Suddenly the trees thinned in front of me, and I understood with delight that I was coming to the end of the wood, whence I could see the army and find the marshal. Where the track comes out from amid the trees there is a small cabaret, where woodcutters and wagoners drink their wine. Outside the door of this, I reined up my horse for an instant, while I took in the scene which was before me. Some few miles away I saw a second great forest, that of St. Lambert, out of which the Emperor had seen the troops advancing. It was easy to see, however, why there had been so long a delay in their leaving one wood and reaching the other, because between the two ran the deep defile of the Lassens, which had to be crossed. Sure enough, a long column of troops, horse, foot, and guns, was streaming down one side of it, and swarming up the other, while the advance guard was already among the trees on either side of me. A battery of horse artillery was coming along the road, and I was about to gallop up to it, and ask the officer in command if he could tell me where I should find the marshal, when suddenly I observed that, though the gunners were dressed in blue, they had not the dolman trimmed with red Brandenburgs as our own horse gunners wear it. Amazed at the sight, I was looking at these soldiers to left and right when a hand touched my thigh, and there was the landlord, who had rushed from his inn. "Madman," he cried, "why are you here? What are you doing?" "I am seeking Marshal Grouchy." "You are in the heart of the Prussian army. Turn and fly." "Impossible, this is Grouchy's corps." "How do you know?" "Because the Emperor has said it." "Then the Emperor has made a terrible mistake. I tell you that a patrol of Silesian hussars has this instant left me." "Did you not see them in the wood?" "I saw hussars. They are the enemy." "Where is Grouchy?" "He is behind." "They have passed him." "Then how can I go back? If I go forward I may see him yet. I must obey my orders and find him where Ever sick he is." The man reflected for an instant. "Quick, quick," he cried, seizing my bridle. "Oh, what I say, and you may yet escape. They have not observed you yet. Come with me, and I will hide you until they pass." Behind his house there was a low stable, and into this he thrust Violette. Then he half led and half dragged me into the kitchen of the inn. It was a bare, brick-floored room. A stout, red-faced woman was cooking cutlets at the fire. "What's the matter now?" she asked, looking with a frown from me to the innkeeper. "Oh, is this you have brought in?" "It is a French officer, Marie. We cannot let the Prussians take him." "Why not? Why not? Sacred name of a dog, was I not myself a soldier of Napoleon? Did I not win a musket of honor among the Velites of the Guard? Shall I see a comrade taken before my eyes? Marie, we must save him." But the lady looked at me with most unfriendly eyes. "Pierre Cheras," she said, "you will not rest until you have your house burned over your head. Do you not understand, you blockhead, that if you fought for Napoleon it was because Napoleon ruled Belgium? He does so no longer. The Prussians are our allies and this is our enemy. I will have no Frenchman in this house. Give him up." The innkeeper scratched his head and looked at me in despair, but it was very evident to me that it was neither for France nor for Belgium that this woman cared, but that it was the safety of her own house that was nearest her heart. "Madam," said I, with all the dignity and assurance I could command, "the Emperor is defeating the English, and the French army will be here before evening. If you have used me well you will be rewarded, and if you have denounced me, you will be punished, and your house will certainly be burned by the provost marshal." She was shaken by this, and I hastened to complete my victory by other methods. "Surely," said I, "it is impossible that anyone so beautiful can also be hard-hearted. You will not refuse me the refuge which I need." She looked at my whiskers and I saw that she was softened. I took her hand, and in 2 minutes we were on such terms that her husband swore roundly that he would give me up himself if I pressed the matter farther. "Besides, the road is full of Prussians," he cried. "Quick, quick, into the loft. Quick, quick, into the loft," echoed his wife, and together they hurried me toward a ladder which led to a trapdoor in the ceiling. There was loud knocking at the door, so you can think that it was not long before my spurs went twinkling through the hole, and the board was dropped behind me. An instant later I heard the voices of the Germans in the rooms below me. The place in which I found myself was a single long attic, the ceiling of which was formed by the roof of the house. It ran over the whole of one side of the inn, and through the cracks in the flooring I could look down either upon the kitchen, the sitting room, or the bar at my pleasure. There were no windows, but the place was in the last stage of disrepair, and several missing slates upon the roof gave me light and the means of observation. The place was heaped with lumber fodder at one end, and a huge pile of empty bottles at the other. There was no door or window save the hole through which I had come up. I sat upon the heap of hay for a few minutes to steady myself, and to think out my plans. It was very serious that the Prussians should arrive upon the field of battle earlier than our reserves, but there appeared to be only one corps of them, and a corps more or less makes little difference to such a man as the Emperor. He could afford to give the English all this, and beat them still. The best way in which I could serve him, since Crouchy was behind, was to wait here until they were past, and then to resume my journey, to see the Marshal, and to give him his orders. If he advanced upon the rear of the English instead of following the Prussians, all would be well. The fate of France depended upon my judgment and my nerve. It was not the first time, my friends, as you are well aware, and you know the reasons, that I had to trust that neither nerve nor judgment would ever fail me. Certainly, the Emperor had chosen the right man for his mission. He Prince of Messengers he had called me. I would earn my title. It was clear that I could do nothing until the Prussians had passed, so I spent my time in observing them. I have no love for these people, but I am compelled to say that they kept excellent discipline, for not a man of them entered the inn, though their lips were caked with dust, and they were ready to drop with fatigue. Those who had knocked at the door were bearing an insensible comrade, and having left him, they returned at once to the ranks. Several others were carried in the same fashion and laid in the kitchen, while a young surgeon, little more than a boy, remained behind in charge of them. Having observed them through the cracks in the floor, I next turned my attention to the holes in the roof, from which I had an excellent view of all that was passing outside. The Prussian corps was still streaming past. It was easy to see that they had made a terrible march, and had little food. For the faces of the men were ghastly, and they were plastered from head to foot with mud from their falls upon the foul and slippery roads. Yet, spent as they were, their spirit was excellent, and they pushed and hauled at the gun carriages when the wheels sank up to the axles in the mire, and the weary horses were floundering knee-deep unable to draw them through. The officers rode up and down the column encouraging the more active with words of praise, and the laggards with blows from the flat of their swords. All the time from over the wood in front of them there came the tremendous roar of the battle, as if all the rivers on earth had united in one gigantic cataract, booming and crashing in a mighty fall. Like the spray of the cataract was the long veil of smoke which rose high over the trees. The officers pointed to it with their swords, and with hoarse cries from their parched lips the mud-stained men pushed onward to the battle. For an hour I watched them pass, and I reflected that their vanguard must have come into touch with Marbot's vedettes, and that the Emperor knew already of their coming. You are going very fast up the road, my friends, but you will come down it a great deal faster, said I to myself, and I consoled myself with the thought. But an adventure came to break the monotony of this long wait. I was seated beside my loophole and congratulating myself that the corps was nearly past, and that the road would soon be clear for my journey, when suddenly I heard a loud altercation break out in French in the kitchen. "You shall not go," cried a woman's voice. "I tell you that I will," said a man's, and there was a sound of scuffling. In an instant I had my eye to the crack in the floor. There was my stout lady, like a faithful watchdog, at the bottom of the ladder, while the young German surgeon, white with anger, was endeavoring to come up it. Several of the German soldiers who had recovered from their prostration were sitting about on the kitchen floor and watching the quarrel with stolid, but attentive, faces. The landlord was nowhere to be seen. "There is no liquor there," said the woman. "I do not want liquor. I want hay or straw for these men to lie upon. Why should they lie on the bricks when there is straw overhead?" "There is no straw. What is up there?" "Empty bottles." "Nothing else?" "No." For a moment it looked as if the surgeon would abandon his intention, but one of the soldiers pointed up to the ceiling. I gathered from what I could understand of his words that he could see the straw sticking out between the planks. In vain the woman protested. Two of the soldiers were able to get upon their feet and to drag her aside, while the young surgeon ran up the ladder, pushed open the trapdoor, and climbed into the loft. As he swung the door back, I slipped behind it, but as luck would have it, he shut it again behind him, and there we were left standing face to face. Never have I seen a more astonished young man. A French officer, he gasped. Hush, said I, hush. Not a word above a whisper. I had drawn my sword. I am not a combatant, he said. I am a doctor. Why do you threaten me with your sword? I am not armed. I do not wish to hurt you, but I must protect myself. I am in hiding here. A spy. A spy does not wear such a uniform as this, nor do you find spies on the staff of an army. I rode by mistake into the heart of this Prussian corps, and I concealed myself here in the hope of escaping when they are past. I will not hurt you, if you do not hurt me, but if you do not swear that you will be silent, as to my presence you will never go down alive from this attic. You can put up your sword, sir, said the surgeon, and I saw a friendly twinkle in his eyes. I'm a Pole by birth, and I have no ill feeling to you or your people. I will do my best for my patients, but I will do no more. Capturing hussars is not one of the duties of a surgeon. With your permission, I will now descend with this truss of hay to make a couch for these poor fellows below. I had intended to exact an oath from him, but it is my experience that if a man will not speak the truth, he will not swear the truth, so I said no more. The surgeon opened the trapdoor, threw out enough hay for his purpose, and then descended the ladder, letting down the door behind him. I watched him anxiously when he rejoined his patients, and so did my good friend the landlady, but he said nothing, and busied himself with the needs of his soldiers. By this time I was sure that the last of the army corps was past, and I went to my loophole confident that I should find the coast clear, save, perhaps, for a few stragglers, whom I could disregard. The first corps was indeed past, and I could see the last files of the infantry disappearing into the wood. But you can imagine my disappointment when out of the forest of St. Lambert I saw a second corps emerging, as numerous as the first. There could be no doubt that the whole Prussian army, which we thought we had destroyed at Ligny, was about to throw itself upon our right wing, while Marshal Grouchy had been coaxed away upon some fool's errand. The roar of guns, much nearer than before, told me that the Prussian batteries which had passed me were already in action. Imagine my terrible position. Hour after hour was passing, the sun was sinking toward the west. And yet this cursed inn, in which I lay hid, was like a little island amid a rushing stream of furious Prussians. It was all important that I should reach Marshal Grouchy, and yet I could not show my nose without being made prisoner. You can think how I cursed and tore my hair. How little do we know what is in store for us. Even while I raged against my ill fortune, that same fortune was reserving me for a far higher task than to carry a message to Grouchy, a task which could not have been mine had I not been held tight in that little inn on the edge of the forest of Paris. Two Prussian corps had passed and a third was coming up, when I heard a great fuss, and the sound of several voices, in the sitting room. By altering my position I was able to look down, and see what was going on. Two Prussian generals were beneath me, their heads bent over a map which lay upon the table. Several aides-de-camp and staff officers stood round in silence. Of the two generals, one was a fierce old man, white-haired and wrinkled, with a ragged, grizzled mustache and a voice like the bark of a hound. The other was younger, but long-faced and solemn. He measured distances upon the map with the air of a student, while his companion stamped and fumed and cursed like a corporal of hussars. It was strange to see the old man so fiery, and the young one so reserved. I could not understand all that they said, but I was very sure about their general meaning. I tell you we must push on and ever on, cried the old fellow, with a furious German oath. Promised Wellington that I would be there with the whole army, even if I had to be strapped to my horse. Bülow's corps is in action, and Ziethen shall support it with every man and gun. Forward, Neissen, forward. The other shook his head. You must remember, Your Excellency, that if the English are beaten they will make for the coast. What will your position be then, with Grouchy between you and the Rhine? We shall beat them, nice in it. The Duke and I will grind them to powder between us. Push on, I say. The whole war will be ended in one blow. Bring Pursh up, and we can throw 60,000 men into the scale, while Thielman holds Grouchy beyond Waver. Nysena shrugged his shoulders, but at that instant an orderly appeared at the door. An aide-de-camp from the Duke of Wellington, said he. Ha, ha, cried the old man. Let us hear what he has to say. An English officer, with mud and blood all over his scarlet jacket, staggered into the room. A crimson-stained handkerchief was knotted round his arm, and he held the table, to keep himself from falling. My message is to Marshal Blücher, said he. I am Marshal Blücher. Go on, cried the impatient old man. The Duke bade me to tell you, sir, that the British army can hold its own, and that he has no fears for the result. The French cavalry has been destroyed. Two of their divisions of infantry have ceased to exist, and only the Guard is in reserve. If you give us a vigorous support, the defeat will be changed to absolute rout, and his knees gave way under him, and he fell in a heap upon the floor. Enough! Enough! Cried Blücher. Nysena, send an aide-de-camp to Wellington, and tell him to rely upon me to the full. Come on, gentlemen, we have our work to do. He bustled eagerly out of the room with all his staff clanking behind him, while two orderlies carried the English messenger to the care of the surgeon. Nysena, the chief of the staff, had lingered behind for an instant, and he laid his hand upon one of the aides de camp. The fellow had attracted my attention, for I have always a quick eye for a fine man. He was tall and slender, the very model of a horseman. Indeed, there was something in his appearance which made it not unlike my own. His face was dark, and as keen as that of a hawk, with fierce black eyes under thick shaggy brows, and a mustache which would have put him in the crack squadron of my hussars. He wore a green coat with white facings, and a horsehair helmet, a dragoon, as I conjectured, and as dashing a cavalier as one would wish to have at the end of one sword point. A word with you, Count Stein, said Nysena. If the enemy are routed, but if the Emperor escapes, he will rally another army, and all will have to be done again. But if we can get the Emperor, then the war is indeed ended. It is worth a great effort, and a great risk for such an object as that. The young dragoon said nothing, but he listened attentively. Suppose the Duke of Wellington's words should prove to be correct, and the French army should be driven in utter rout from the field, the Emperor will certainly take the road back through Genappe and Charleroi as being the shortest to the frontier. We can imagine that his horses will be fleet, and that the fugitives will make way for him. Our cavalry will follow the rear of the beaten army, but the Emperor will be far away at the front of the throng. The young dragoon inclined his head. To you, Count Stein, I commit the Emperor. If you take him, your name will live in history. You have the reputation of being the hardest rider in our army. Do you choose such comrades as you may select? 10 or 12 should be enough. You are not to engage in the battle, nor are you to follow the general pursuit, but you are to ride clear of the crowd, reserving your energies for a nobler end. Do you understand me? Again the dragoon inclined his head. This silence impressed me. I felt that he was indeed a dangerous man. Then I leave the details in your own hands. Strike at no one except the highest. You cannot mistake the imperial carriage, nor can you fail to recognize the figure of the Emperor. Now I must follow the marshal. Adieu. If ever I see you again, I trust that it will be to congratulate you upon a deed which will ring through Europe. The dragoon saluted and Nysena hurried from the room. The young officer stood in deep thought for a few moments. Then he followed the chief of the staff. I looked with curiosity from my loophole to see what his next proceeding would be. His horse, a fine, strong chestnut with two white stockings, was fastened to the rail of the inn. He sprang into the saddle, and, riding to intercept a column of cavalry which was passing, he spoke to an officer at the head of the leading regiment. Presently after some talk I saw two hussars. It was a hussar regiment drop out of the ranks and take up their position beside Count Stein. The next regiment was also stopped, and two lancers were added to his escort. The next furnished him with two dragoons, and the next with two cuirassiers. Then he drew his little group of horsemen aside, and he gathered them round him, explaining to them what they had to do. Finally the nine soldiers rode off together, and disappeared into the wood of Paris. I need not tell you, my friends, what all this portended. Indeed, he had acted exactly as I should have done in his place. From each colonel he had demanded the two best horsemen in the regiment, and so he had assembled a band who might expect to catch whatever they should follow. Heaven help the emperor if, without an escort, he should find them on his track. And I, dear friends, imagine the fever, the ferment, the madness of my mind. All thought of Grouchy had passed away. No guns were to be heard to the east. He could not be near. If he should come up he would not now be in time to alter the event of the day. The sun was already low in the sky, and there could not be more than 2 or 3 hours of daylight. My mission might be dismissed as useless. But here was another mission, more pressing, more immediate, a mission which meant the safety, and perhaps the life, of the emperor. At all costs, through every danger, I must get back to his side. But how was I to do it? The whole Prussian army was now between me and the French lines. They blocked every road, but they could not block the path of duty when Etienne Gerard sees it lie before him. I could not wait longer. I must be gone. There was but the one opening to the loft, and so it was only down the ladder that I could descend. I looked into the kitchen, and I found that the young surgeon was still there. In a chair sat the wounded English aide-de-camp, and on the straw lay two Prussian soldiers in the last stage of exhaustion. The others had all recovered and been sent on. These were my enemies, and I must pass through them in order to gain my horse. From the surgeon I had nothing to fear. The Englishman was wounded, and his sword stood with his cloak in a corner. The two Germans were half insensible, and their muskets were not beside them. What could be simpler? I opened the trapdoor, slipped down the ladder, and appeared in the midst of them, my sword drawn in my hand. What a picture of surprise! The surgeon, of course, knew all, but to the Englishman and the two Germans it must have seemed that the god of war in person had descended from the skies. With my appearance, with my figure, with my silver and gray uniform, and with that gleaming sword in my hand, I must indeed have been a sight worth seeing. The two Germans lay petrified with staring eyes. The English officer half rose, but sat down again from weakness, his mouth open and his hand on the back of his chair. "What the deuce?" he kept on repeating, "what the deuce?" "Pray do not move," said I. "I will hurt no one, but woe to the man who lays hands upon me to stop me. You have nothing to fear if you leave me alone, and nothing to hope if you try to hinder me. I am Colonel Etienne Gerard, of the Hussars of Conflans." "The deuce," said the Englishman. "Who are the man that killed the fox?" A terrible scowl had darkened his face. The jealousy of sportsmen is a base passion. He hated me, this Englishman, because I had been before him in transfixing the animal. How different are our natures! Had I seen him do such a deed I would have embraced him with cries of joy. But there was no time for argument. "I regret it, sir," said I, "but you have a cloak here, and I must take it." He tried to rise from his chair and reach his sword, but I got between him and the corner where it lay. "If there is anything in the pockets, a case," said he. "I would not rob you," said I, and raising the cloak I took from the pockets a silver flask, a square wooden case and a field glass. All these I handed to him. The wretch opened the case, took out a pistol, and pointed it straight at my head. "Now, my fine fellow," said he, "put down your sword, and give yourself up." I was so astounded at this infamous action that I stood petrified before him. I tried to speak to him of honor and gratitude, but I saw his eyes fix and harden over the pistol. "Enough talk," said he. "Drop it." Could I endure such a humiliation? death were better than to be disarmed in such a fashion. The word fire was on my lips, when in an instant the Englishman vanished from before my face, and in his place was a great pile of hay, with a red-coated arm and two Hessian boots waving and kicking in the heart of it. Oh, the gallant landlady! It was my whiskers that had saved me. Fly, soldier, fly, she cried, and she heaped fresh trusses of hay from the floor onto the struggling Englishman. In an instant I was out in the courtyard, had let Violet from her stable, and was on her back. A pistol bullet whizzed past my shoulder from the window, and I saw a furious face looking out at me. I smiled my contempt and spurred out into the road. The last of the Prussians had passed, and both my road and my duty lay clear before me. If France won, all well. If France lost, then on me and my little mare depended that which was more than victory or defeat, the safety and the life of the Emperor. N.A.T.N. on, I cried. Of all your noble exploits, the greatest, even if it be the last, lies now before you. 2. The story of the 9 Prussian horsemen. I told you when last we met, my friends, of the important mission from the Emperor to Marshal Grouchy, which failed through no fault of my own, and I described to you how during a long afternoon I was shut up in the attic of a country inn, and was prevented from coming out, because the Prussians were all around me. You will remember also how I overheard the chief of the Prussian staff give his instructions to Count Stein, and so learned the dangerous plan which was on foot to kill or capture the Emperor in the event of a French defeat. At first I could not have believed in such a thing, but since the guns had thundered all day, and since the sound had made no advance in my direction, it was evident that the English had at least held their own and beaten off all our attacks. I have said that it was a fight that day between the soul of France and the beef of England, but it must be confessed that we found the beef was very tough. It was clear that if the Emperor could not defeat the English when alone, then it might, indeed, go hard with him now that 60,000 of these cursed Prussians were swarming on his flank. In any case, with this secret in my possession, my place was by his side. I had made my way out of the inn in the dashing manner which I have described to you when last we met, and I left the English aide-de-camp shaking his foolish fist out of the window. I could not but laugh as I looked back at him, for his angry red face was framed and frilled with hay. Once out on the road I stood erect in my stirrups, and I put on the handsome black riding coat, lined with red, which had belonged to him. It fell to the top of my high boots, and covered my telltale uniform completely. As to my busby, there are many such in the German service, and there was no reason why it should attract attention. So long as no one spoke to me, there was no reason why I should not ride through the whole of the Prussian army. But though I understood German, for I had many friends among the German ladies during the pleasant years that I fought all over that country, still I spoke it with a pretty Parisian accent which could not be confounded with their rough, unmusical speech. I knew that this quality of my accent would attract attention, but I could only hope and pray that I would be permitted to go my way in silence. The forest of Paris was so large that it was useless to think of going round it, and so I took my courage in both hands and galloped on down the road in the track of the Prussian army. It was not hard to trace it, for it was rutted 2 feet deep by the gun wheels and the caissons. Soon I found a fringe of wounded men, Prussians and French, on each side of it, where Bülow's advance had come into touch with Marbot's hussars. One old man with a long white beard, a surgeon, I suppose, shouted at me and ran after me still shouting, but I never turned my head and took no notice of him save to spur on faster. I heard his shouts long after I had lost sight of him among the trees. Presently I came up with the Prussian reserves. The infantry were leaning on their muskets or lying exhausted on the wet ground, and the officers stood in groups listening to the mighty roar of the battle and discussing the reports which came from the front. I hurried past at the top of my speed, but one of them rushed out and stood in my path with his hand up as a signal to me to stop. 5,000 Prussian eyes were turned upon me. There was a moment. You turn pale, my friends, at the thought of it. think how every hair upon me stood on end. But never for one instant did my wits or my courage desert me. "Enrol Blutcher," I cried. Was it not my guardian angel who whispered the words in my ear? The Prussian sprang from my path, saluted, and pointed forward. "They are well disciplined, these Prussians, and who was he, that he should dare to stop the officer who bore a message to the general? It was a talisman that would pass me out of every danger, and my heart sang within me at the thought. So elated was I, that I no longer waited to be asked, but as I rode through the army I shouted to right and left, "General Blutcher! General Blutcher!" And every man pointed me onward, and cleared a path to let me pass. There are times when the most supreme impudence is the highest wisdom. But discretion must also be used, and I must admit that I became indiscreet. For as I rode upon my way, ever nearer to the fighting line, a Prussian officer of Uhlans gripped my bridle and pointed to a group of men who stood near a burning farm. "There is Marshal Blutcher. Deliver your message," said he, and sure enough, my terrible old gray-whiskered veteran was there within a pistol shot, his eyes turned in my direction. But the good guardian angel did not desert me. Quick as a flash there came into my memory the name of the general who commanded the advance of the Prussians. Illust. Caption equals, "Here is Marshal Blutcher. Deliver your message." Right brace, General Bülow," I cried. The Uhlan let go my bridle. "Enrol Bülow. General Bülow," I shouted, as every stride of the dear little mare took me nearer my own people. Through the burning village of Planchenoit I galloped, spurred my way between two columns of Prussian infantry, sprang over a hedge, cut down a Silesian hussar who flung himself before me, and an instant afterward, with my coat flying open to show the uniform below, I passed through the open files of the 10th of the line, and was back in the heart of Laube's corps once more. Outnumbered and outflanked, they were being slowly driven in by the pressure of the Prussian advance. I galloped onward, anxious only to find myself by the Emperor's side. But a sight lay before me which held me fast, as though I had been turned into some noble equestrian statue. I could not move, I could scarce breathe, as I gazed upon it. There was a mound over which my path lay, and as I came out on the top of it, I looked down the long, shallow valley of Waterloo. I had left it with two great armies on either side, and a clear field between them. Now there were but long, ragged fringes of broken and exhausted regiments upon the two ridges, but a real army of dead and wounded lay between. For 2 miles in length and half a mile across the ground, was strewed and heaped with them. But slaughter was no new sight to me, and it was not that which held me spellbound. It was that up the long slope of the British position, was moving a walking forest black, tossing, waving, unbroken. Did I not know the bearskins of the guard? And did I not also know, did not my soldier's instinct tell me, that it was the last reserve of France, that the Emperor, like a desperate gamester, was staking all upon his last card? Up they went and up, grand, solid, unbreakable, scourged with musketry, riddled with grape, flowing onward in a black, heavy tide, which lapped over the British batteries. With my glass I could see the English gunners throw themselves under their pieces or run to the rear. On rolled the crest of the bearskins, and then, with a crash which was swept across to my ears, they met the British infantry. A minute passed, and another, and another. My heart was in my mouth. They swayed back and forward. They no longer advanced. They were held. Great heaven! Was it possible that they were breaking? One black dot ran down the hill, then two, then four, then ten, then a great, scattered, struggling mass, halting, breaking, halting, and at last shredding out and rushing madly downward. The guard is beaten! The guard is beaten! From all around me, I heard the cry. Along the whole line the infantry turned their faces, and the gunners flinched from their guns. The old guard is beaten. The guard retreats. An officer with a livid face passed me yelling out these words of woe. "Ave yourselves! Save yourselves! You are betrayed!" cried another. "Save yourselves! Save yourselves!" Men were rushing madly to the rear, blundering, and jumping like frightened sheep. cries and screams rose from all around me. And at that moment, as I looked at the British position, I saw what I can never forget. A single horseman stood out black and clear upon the ridge against the last red angry glow of the setting sun. So dark, so motionless, against that grim light, he might have been the very spirit of battle brooding over that terrible valley. As I gazed, he raised his hat high in the air, and at the signal, with a low, deep roar like a breaking wave, the whole British army flooded over their ridge and came rolling down into the valley. Long steel-fringed lines of red and blue, sweeping waves of cavalry, horse batteries rattling and bounding, down they came onto our crumbling ranks. It was over. A yell of agony, the agony of brave men who see no hope, rose from one flank to the other, and in an instant the whole of that noble army was swept in a wild, terror-stricken crowd from the field. Even now, dear friends, I cannot, as you see, speak of that dreadful moment with a dry eye, or with a steady voice. At first I was carried away in that wild rush, whirled off like a straw in a flooded gutter. But, suddenly, what should I see amongst the mixed regiments in front of me, but a group of stern horsemen, in silver and gray, with a broken and tattered standard held aloft in the heart of them. Not all the might of England and of Prussia could break the hussars of Conflans. But when I joined them, it made my heart bleed to see them. The major, 7 captains, and 500 men were left upon the field. Young Captain Sabatier was in command, and when I asked him, where were the 5 missing squadrons, he pointed back and answered, "Who will find them round one of those British squares?" Men and horses were at their last gasp, caked with sweat and dirt, their black tongues hanging out from their lips. But it made me thrill with pride to see how that shattered remnant still rode knee to knee with every man, from the boy trumpeter to the farrier sergeant, in his own proper place. Would that I could have brought them on with me as an escort for the Emperor. In the heart of the hussars of Conflans he would be safe indeed. But the horses were too spent to trot. I left them behind me with orders to rally upon the farmhouse of St. Anne, where we had camped 2 nights before. For my own part, I forced my horse through the throng in search of the Emperor. There were things which I saw then, as I pressed through that dreadful crowd, which can never be banished from my mind. In evil dreams there comes back to me the memory of that flowing stream of livid, staring, screaming faces upon which I looked down. It was a nightmare. In victory one does not understand the horror of war. It is only in the cold chill of defeat that it is brought home to you. I remember an old grenadier of the guard lying at the side of the road with his broken leg doubled at a right angle. "Comrades, comrades, keep off my leg," he cried, but they tripped and stumbled over him all the same. In front of me rode a Lancer officer without his coat. His arm had just been taken off in the ambulance. The bandages had fallen. It was horrible. 2 gunners tried to drive through with their gun. A chasseur raised his musket and shot one of them through the head. I saw a major of cuirassiers draw his 2 holster pistols and shoot first his horse and then himself. Beside the road a man in a blue coat was raging and raving like a madman. His face was black with powder, his clothes were torn, 1 epaulette was gone, the other hung dangling over his breast. Only when I came close to him did I recognize that it was Marshal Ney. He howled at the flying troops, and his voice was hardly human. Then he raised the stump of his sword. It was broken 3 inches from the hilt. "Oh man, see how a Marshal of France can die," he cried. Gladly would I have gone with him, but my duty lay elsewhere. He did not, as you know, find the death he sought, but he met it a few weeks later in cold blood at the hands of his enemies. There is an old proverb that in attack the French are more than men, in defeat they are less than women. I knew that it was true that day. But even in that rout I saw things which I can tell with pride. Through the fields which skirt the road moved Cambrin's 3 reserve battalions of the Guard, the cream of our army. They walked slowly in square, their colors waving over the somber line of the bearskins. All round them raged the English cavalry, and the black lancers of Brunswick, wave after wave thundering up, breaking with a crash, and recoiling in ruin. When last I saw them, the English guns, six at a time, were smashing grape shot through their ranks, and the English infantry were closing in upon three sides and pouring volleys into them. But still, like a noble lion with fierce hounds clinging to its flanks, the glorious remnant of the guard, marching slowly, halting, closing up, dressing, moved majestically from their last battle. Behind them the guard's battery of 12-pounders was drawn up upon the ridge. Every gunner was in his place, but no gun fired. "Why do you not fire?" I asked the colonel as I passed. "Powder is finished. Can why not retire? Appearance may hold them back for a little. We must give the emperor time to escape." Such were the soldiers of France. Behind this screen of brave men the others took their breath, and then went on in less desperate fashion. They had broken away from the road, and all over the countryside in the twilight I could see the timid, scattered, frightened crowd who 10 hours before had formed the finest army that ever went down to battle. I, with my splendid mare, was soon able to get clear of the throng, and just after I passed Genappe I overtook the emperor with the remains of his staff. Soult was with him still, and so were Drouet, Laube, and Bertrand, with 5 chasseurs of the guard, their horses hardly able to move. The night was falling, and the emperor's haggard face gleamed white through the gloom as he turned it toward me. "Who is that?" he asked. "It is Colonel Gerard," said Soult. "Have you seen Marshal Grouchy?" "No, sire. The Prussians were between." "It does not matter. Nothing matters now. Soult, I will go back." He tried to turn his horse, but Bertrand seized his bridle. "Sire," said Soult, "the enemy has had good fortune enough already. They forced him on among them." He rode in silence with his chin upon his breast, the greatest and the saddest of men. Far away behind us those remorseless guns were still roaring. Sometimes out of the darkness would come shrieks and screams and the low thunder of galloping hoofs. At the sound we would spur our horses and hasten onward through the scattered troops. At last, after riding all night in the clear moonlight, we found that we had left both pursued and pursuers behind. By the time we passed over the bridge at Charleroi the dawn was breaking. What a company of specters we looked in that cold, clear, searching light, the emperor with his face of wax, Soult blotched with powder, Laube dabbled with blood. But we rode more easily now, and had ceased to glance over our shoulders, for Waterloo was more than 30 miles behind us. One of the emperor's carriages had been picked up at Charleroi, and we halted now on the other side of the Sambre, and dismounted from our horses. You will ask me, why it was that during all this time I had said nothing of that which was nearest my heart, the need for guarding the emperor. As a fact, I had tried to speak of it both to Soult and to Laube, but their minds were so overwhelmed with the disaster, and so distracted by the pressing needs of the moment, that it was impossible to make them understand how urgent was my message. Besides, during this long flight we had always had numbers of French fugitives beside us on the road, and, however demoralized they might be, we had nothing to fear from the attack of 9 men. But now, as we stood round the emperor's carriage in the early morning, I observed with anxiety that not a single French soldier was to be seen upon the long, white road behind us. We had outstripped the army. I looked round to see what means of defense were left to us. The horses of the chasseurs of the guard had broken down, and only one of them, a gray-whiskered sergeant, remained. There were Soult, Laube, and Bertrand. But, for all their talents, I had rather, when it came to hard knocks, have a single quartermaster sergeant of hussars at my side than the 3 of them put together. There remained the emperor himself, the coachman, and a valet of the household who had joined us at Charleroi, 8 all told. But of the 8 only 2, the chasseur and I, were fighting soldiers who could be depended upon at a pinch. A chill came over me as I reflected how utterly helpless we were. At that moment I raised my eyes, and there were the 9 Prussian horsemen coming over the hill. On either side of the road at this point are long stretches of rolling plain, part of it yellow with corn and part of it rich grassland watered by the Sambre. To the south of us was a low ridge, over which was the road to France. Along this road the little group of cavalry was riding. So well had Count Stein obeyed his instructions, that he had struck far to the south of us in his determination to get ahead of the Emperor. Now he was riding from the direction in which we were going, the last in which we could expect an enemy. When I caught that first glimpse of them, they were still half a mile away. "Sire," I cried, "the Prussians!" They all started and stared. It was the Emperor who broke the silence. "Who says they are Prussians?"
"I do, sire, I, Etienne Gerard."
Unpleasant news always made the Emperor furious against the man who broke it. He railed at me now in the rasping, croaking, Corsican voice which only made itself heard when he had lost his self-control. "You were always a buffoon," he cried. "What do you mean, you numbskull, by saying that they are Prussians? How could Prussians be coming from the direction of France? You have lost any wits that you ever possessed." His words cut me like a whip, and yet we all felt toward the Emperor as an old dog does to its master. His kick is soon forgotten and forgiven. I would not argue or justify myself. At the first glance I had seen the two white stockings on the forelegs of the leading horse, and I knew well that Count Stein was on its back. For an instant the nine horsemen had halted and surveyed us. Now they put spurs to their horses, and with a yell of triumph they galloped down the road. They had recognized that their prey was in their power. At that swift advance all doubt had vanished. "Why heavens, sire, it is indeed the Prussians!" cried Soult. Laba and Bertrand ran about the road like two frightened hens. The sergeant of chasseurs drew his saber with a volley of curses. The coachman and the valet cried, and wrung their hands. Napoleon stood with a frozen face, one foot on the step of the carriage. And my friends, I was magnificent. What words can I use to do justice to my own bearing at that supreme instant of my life? So coldly alert, so deadly cool, so clear in brain and ready in hand. He had called me a numbskull and a buffoon. How quick and how noble was my revenge! When his own wits failed him, it was Etienne Gerard who supplied the want. To fight was absurd. To fly was ridiculous. The Emperor was stout and weary to death. At the best he was never a good rider. How could he fly from these, the picked men of an army? The best horseman in Prussia was among them. But I was the best horseman in France. I, and only I, could hold my own with them. If they were on my track instead of the Emperor's, all might still be well. These were the thoughts which flashed so swiftly through my mind, that in an instant I had sprung from the first idea to the final conclusion. Another instant carried me from the final conclusion to prompt and vigorous action. I rushed to the side of the Emperor, who stood petrified, with the carriage between him and our enemies. "Our coat, sire! Your hat!" I cried. I dragged them of him. Never had he been so hustled in his life. In an instant I had them on, and had thrust him into the carriage. The next I had sprung on to his famous white Arab, and had ridden clear of the group upon the road. You have already divined my plan, but you may well ask how could I hope to pass myself off as the Emperor. My figure is as you still see it, and his was never beautiful, for he was both short and stout. But a man's height is not remarked when he is in the saddle, and for the rest one had but to sit forward on the horse and round one's back, and carry oneself like a sack of flour. I wore the little cocked hat, and the loose gray coat with the silver star which was known to every child from one end of Europe to the other. Beneath me was the Emperor's own famous white charger. It was complete. Already as I rode clear the Prussians were within 200 yards of us. I made a gesture of terror and despair with my hands, and I sprang my horse over the bank which lined the road. It was enough. A yell of exultation and of furious hatred broke from the Prussians. It was the howl of starving wolves who scent their prey. I spurred my horse over the meadow land and looked back under my arm as I rode. Oh, the glorious moment when one after the other I saw 8 horsemen come over the bank at my heels. Only one had stayed behind, and I heard shouting, and the sounds of a struggle. I remembered my old sergeant of chasseurs, and I was sure that number 9 would trouble us no more. The road was clear, and the Emperor free to continue his journey.
But now I had to think of myself. If I were overtaken, the Prussians would certainly make short work of me in their disappointment. If it were so, if I lost my life, I should still have sold it at a glorious price. But I had hopes that I might shake them off. With ordinary horsemen upon ordinary horses, I should have had no difficulty in doing so, but here both steeds and riders were of the best. It was a grand creature that I rode, but it was weary with its long night's work, and the Emperor was one of those riders who do not know how to manage a horse. He had little thought for them, and a heavy hand upon their mouths. On the other hand, Stein and his men had come both far and fast. The race was a fair one. So quick had been my impulse, and so rapidly had I acted upon it, that I had not thought enough of my own safety. Had I done so in the first instance, I should, of course, have ridden straight back the way we had come, for so I should have met our own people. But I was off the road, and had galloped a mile over the plain before this occurred to me. Then when I looked back, I saw that the Prussians had spread out into a long line, so as to head me off from the Charlero I rode. I could not turn back, but at least I could edge toward the north. I knew that the whole face of the country was covered with our flying troops, and that sooner or later I must come upon some of them. But one thing I had forgotten, the Sambre. In my excitement I never gave it a thought until I saw it, deep and broad, gleaming in the morning sunlight. It barred my path, and the Prussians howled behind me. I galloped to the brink, but the horse refused the plunge. I spurred him, but the bank was high, and the stream deep. He shrank back trembling and snorting. The yells of triumph were louder every instant. I turned and rode for my life down the river bank. It formed a loop at this part, and I must get across somehow, for my retreat was blocked. Suddenly a thrill of hope ran through me, for I saw a house on my side of the stream, and another on the farther bank. Where there are two such houses, it usually means that there is a ford between them. A sloping path led to the brink, and I urged my horse down it. On he went, the water up to the saddle, the foam flying right and left. He blundered once, and I thought we were lost, but he recovered, and an instant later was clattering up the farther slope. As we came out, I heard the splash behind me as the first Prussian took the water. There was just the breadth of the Sambre between us. I rode with my head sunk between my shoulders in Napoleon's fashion, and I did not dare to look back for fear they should see my mustache. I had turned up the collar of the gray coat so as partly to hide it. Even now, if they found out their mistake, they might turn and overtake the carriage. But when once we were on the road, I could tell by the drumming of their hoofs how far distant they were, and it seemed to me that the sound grew perceptibly louder, as if they were slowly gaining upon me. We were riding now up the stony and rutted lane which led from the ford. I peeped back very cautiously from under my arm, and I perceived that my danger came from a single rider, who was far ahead of his comrades. He was a hussar, a very tiny fellow, upon a big black horse, and it was his light weight which had brought him into the foremost place. It is a place of honor, but it is also a place of danger, as he was soon to learn. I felt the holsters, but, to my horror, there were no pistols. There was a field glass in one, and the other was stuffed with papers. My sword had been left behind with Violette. Had I only my own weapons, and my own little mare, I could have played with these rascals. But I was not entirely unarmed. The Emperor's own sword hung to the saddle. It was curved and short, the hilt all crusted with gold, a thing more fitted to glitter at a review than to serve a soldier in his deadly need. I drew it, such as it was, and I waited my chance. Every instant the clink and clatter of the hoofs grew nearer. I heard the panting of the horse, and the fellow shouted some threat at me. There was a turn in the lane, and as I rounded it, I drew up my white arrow on his haunches. As we spun round, I met the Prussian hussar face to face. He was going too fast to stop, and his only chance was to ride me down. Had he done so, he might have met his own death, but he would have injured me, or my horse, past all hope of escape. But the fool flinched as he saw me waiting, and flew past me on my right. I lunged over my Arab's neck and buried my toy sword in his side. It must have been the finest steel, and as sharp as a razor, for I hardly felt it enter, and yet his blood was within 3 inches of the hilt. His horse galloped on, and he kept his saddle for 100 yards, before he sank down with his face on the mane, and then dived over the side of the neck onto the road. For my own part, I was already at his horse's heels. A few seconds had sufficed for all that I have told. I heard the cry of rage and vengeance which rose from the Prussians as they passed their dead comrade, and I could not but smile as I wondered what they could think of the Emperor as a horseman and a swordsman. I glanced back cautiously as before, and I saw that none of the 7 men stopped. The fate of their comrade was nothing compared to the carrying out of their mission. They were as untiring and as remorseless as bloodhounds. But I had a good lead, and the brave Arab was still going well. I thought that I was safe. And yet it was at that very instant that the most terrible danger befell me. The lane divided, and I took the smaller of the 2 divisions, because it was the more grassy, and the easier for the horse's hoofs. Imagine my horror when, riding through a gate, I found myself in a square of stables and farm buildings, with no way out save that by which I had come. Ah, my friends, if my hair is snowy white, have I not had enough to make it so? To retreat was impossible. I could hear the thunder of the Prussians' hoofs in the lane. I looked round me, and nature has blessed me with that quick eye which is the first of gifts to any soldier, but most of all to a leader of cavalry. Between a long, low line of stables and the farmhouse there was a pigsty. Its front was made of bars of wood 4 feet high, the back was of stone, higher than the front. What was beyond I could not tell. The space between the front and the back was not more than a few yards. It was a desperate venture, and yet I must take it. Every instant the beating of those hurrying hoofs was louder and louder. I put my Arab at the pigsty. She cleared the front beautifully, and came down with her forefeet upon the sleeping pig within, slipping forward upon her knees. I was thrown over the wall beyond, and fell upon my hands and face in a soft flower bed. My horse was upon one side of the wall, I upon the other, and the Prussians were pouring into the yard. But I was up in an instant, and had seized the bridle of the plunging horse over the top of the wall. It was built of loose stones, and I dragged down a few of them to make a gap. As I tugged at the bridle, and shouted, the gallant creature rose to the leap, and an instant afterward she was by my side, and I with my foot on the stirrup. An heroic idea had entered my mind as I mounted into the saddle. These Prussians, if they came over the pigsty, could only come one at once, and their attack would not be formidable when they had not had time to recover from such a leap. Why should I not wait and kill them one by one as they came over? It was a glorious thought. They would learn that Etienne Gerard was not a safe man to hunt. My hand felt for my sword. But you can imagine my feelings, my friends, when I came upon an empty scabbard. It had been shaken out when the horse had tripped over that infernal pig. On what absurd trifles do our destinies hang, a pig on one side, Etienne Gerard on the other. Could I spring over the wall and get the sword? Impossible. The Prussians were already in the yard. I turned my Arab and resumed my flight. But for a moment it seemed to me that I was in a far worse trap than before. I found myself in the garden of the farmhouse, an orchard in the center and flower beds all round. A high wall surrounded the whole place. I reflected, however, that there must be some point of entrance, since every visitor could not be expected to spring over the pigsty. I rode round the wall. As I expected, I came upon a door with a key upon the inner side. I dismounted, unlocked it, opened it, and there was a Prussian lancer sitting his horse within 6 feet of me. For a moment we each stared at the other. Then I shut the door, and locked it again. A crash and a cry came from the other end of the garden. I understood that one of my enemies had come to grief in trying to get over the pigsty. How could I ever get out of this cul-de-sac? It was evident that some of the party had galloped round, while some had followed straight upon my tracks. Had I my sword, I might have beaten off the lancer at the door, but to come out now was to be butchered. And yet if I waited, some of them would certainly follow me on foot over the pigsty, and what could I do then? I must act at once, or I was lost. But it is at such moments that my wits are most active, and my actions most prompt. Still leading my horse, I ran 400 yards by the side of the wall away from the spot where the lancer was watching. There I stopped, and with an effort I tumbled down several of the loose stones from the top of the wall. The instant I had done so, I hurried back to the door. As I had expected, he thought I was making a gap for my escape at that point, and I heard the thud of his horse's hoofs as he galloped to cut me off. As I reached the gate, I looked back, and I saw a green-coated horseman, whom I knew to be Count Stein, clear the pigsty and gallop furiously with a shout of triumph across the garden. "Surrender, your majesty, surrender," he yelled. "We will give you quarter." I slipped through the gate, but had no time to lock it on the other side. Stein was at my very heels, and the lancer had already turned his horse. Springing upon my Arab's back, I was off once more with a clear stretch of grassland before me. Stein had to dismount to open the gate, to lead his horse through, and to mount again, before he could follow. It was he that I feared, rather than the lancer, whose horse was coarse-bred and weary. I galloped hard for a mile, before I ventured to look back, and then Stein was a musket shot from me, and the lancer as much again, while only 3 of the others were in sight. My 9 Prussians were coming down to more manageable numbers, and yet one was too much for an unarmed man. It had surprised me that during this long chase I had seen no fugitives from the army, but I reflected that I was considerably to the west of their line of flight, and that I must edge more toward the east if I wished to join them. Unless I did so, it was probable that my pursuers, even if they could not overtake me themselves, would keep me in view until I was headed off by some of their comrades coming from the north. As I looked to the eastward, I saw far off a line of dust which stretched 4 miles across the country. This was certainly the main road along which our unhappy army was flying. But I soon had proof that some of our stragglers had wandered into these side tracks, for I came suddenly upon a horse grazing at the corner of a field, and beside him, with his back against the bank, his master, a French cuirassier, terribly wounded and evidently on the point of death. I sprang down, seized his long, heavy sword, and rode on with it. Never shall I forget the poor man's face as he looked at me with his failing sight. He was an old, gray moustached soldier, one of the real fanatics, and to him this last vision of his emperor was like a revelation from on high. Astonishment, love, pride, all shone in his pallid face. He said something, I fear they were his last words, but I had no time to listen, and I galloped on my way. All this time I had been on the meadow land, which was intersected in this part by broad ditches. Some of them could not have been less than from 14 to 15 feet, and my heart was in my mouth as I went at each of them, for a slip would have been my ruin. But whoever selected the emperor's horses had done his work well. The creature, save when it balked on the bank of the Sambre, never failed me for an instant. We cleared everything in one stride. And yet we could not shake off those infernal Prussians. As I left each water course behind me, I looked back with renewed hope, but it was only to see Stein on his white-legged chestnut flying over it as lightly as I had done myself. He was my enemy, but I honored him for the way in which he carried himself that day. Again and again I measured the distance which separated him from the next horseman. I had the idea that I might turn and cut him down, as I had the hussar, before his comrade could come to his help. But the others had closed up and ere not far behind. I reflected that this Stein was probably as fine a swordsman as he was a rider, and that it might take me some little time to get the better of him. In that case the others would come to his aid and I should be lost. On the whole, it was wiser to continue my flight. A road with poplars on either side ran across the plain from east to west. It would lead me toward that long line of dust which marked the French retreat. I wheeled my horse, therefore, and galloped down it. As I rode, I saw a single house in front of me upon the right, with a great bush hung over the door, to mark it as an inn. Outside there were several peasants, but for them I cared nothing. What frightened me was to see the gleam of a red coat, which showed that there were British in the place. However, I could not turn, and I could not stop, so there was nothing for it, but to gallop on and to take my chance. There were no troops in sight, so these men must be stragglers or marauders, from whom I had little to fear. As I approached, I saw that there were two of them sitting drinking on a bench outside the inn door. I saw them stagger to their feet, and it was evident that they were both very drunk. One stood swaying in the middle of the road. "It's Tony. So help me, it's Tony," he yelled. He ran with his hands out to catch me, but luckily for himself his drunken feet stumbled, and he fell on his face on the road. The other was more dangerous. He had rushed into the inn, and just as I passed I saw him run out with his musket in his hand. He dropped upon one knee, and I stooped forward over my horse's neck. A single shot from a Prussian or an Austrian is a small matter, but the British were at that time the best shots in Europe, and my drunkard seemed steady enough when he had a gun at his shoulder. I heard the crack, and my horse gave a convulsive spring which would have unseated many a rider. For an instant I thought he was killed, but when I turned in my saddle I saw a stream of blood running down the off hind quarter. I looked back at the Englishman, and the brute had bitten the end off another cartridge, and was ramming it into his musket, but before he had it primed we were beyond his range. These men were foot soldiers, and could not join in the chase, but I heard them whooping, and tally-hoing behind me, as if I had been a fox. The peasants also shouted, and ran through the fields flourishing their sticks. From all sides I heard cries, and everywhere were the rushing, waving figures of my pursuers. To think of the great emperor being chivied over the countryside in this fashion. It made me long to have these rascals within the sweep of my sword. But now I felt that I was nearing the end of my course. I had done all that a man could be expected to do, some would say more, but at last I had come to a point from which I could see no escape. The horses of my pursuers were exhausted, but mine was exhausted and wounded also. It was losing blood fast, and we left a red trail upon the white, moldy road. Already his pace was slackening, and sooner or later he must drop under me. I looked back, and there were the five inevitable Prussians, Stein 100 yards in front, then a lancer, and then three others riding together. Stein had drawn his sword, and he waved it at me. For my own part I was determined not to give myself up. I would try how many of these Prussians I could take with me into the other world. At this supreme moment all the great deeds of my life rose in a vision before me, and I felt that this, my last exploit, was indeed a worthy close to such a career. My death would be a fatal blow to those who loved me, to my dear mother, to my hussars, to others who shall be nameless. But all of them had my honor and my fame at heart, and I felt that their grief would be tinged with pride when they learned how I had ridden and how I had fought upon this last day. Therefore I hardened my heart, and, as my Arab limped more and more upon his wounded leg, I drew the great sword which I had taken from the cuirassier, and I set my teeth for my supreme struggle. My H hand was in the very act of tightening the bridle, for I feared that, if I delayed longer I might find myself on foot fighting against five mounted men. At that instant my eye fell upon something which brought hope to my heart, and a shout of joy to my lips. From a grove of trees in front of me there projected the steeple of a village church. But there could not be two steeples like that, for the corner of it had crumbled away, or been struck by lightning, so that it was of a most fantastic shape. I had seen it only 2 days before, and it was the church of the village of Gosleys. It was not the hope of reaching the village which set my heart singing with joy, but it was that I knew my ground now, and that farmhouse not half a mile ahead, with its gable end sticking out from amid the trees, must be that very farm of St. Anne where we had bivouacked, and which I had named to Captain Sabatier as the rendezvous of the hussars of Conflans. There they were, my little rascals, if I could but reach them. With every bound my horse grew weaker. Each instant the sound of the pursuit grew louder. I heard a gust of crackling German oaths at my very heels. A pistol bullet sighed in my ears. Spurring frantically and beating my poor Arab with the flat of my sword, I kept him at the top of his speed. The open gate of the farmyard lay before me. I saw the twinkle of steel within. Stein's horse's head was within 10 yards of me as I thundered through. To me, comrades! To me! I yelled. I heard a buzz as when the angry bees swarm from their nest. Then my splendid white Arab fell dead under me, and I was hurled onto the cobblestones of the yard, where I can remember no more. Such was my last and most famous exploit, my dear friends, a story which rang through Europe, and has made the name of Etienne Gerard famous in history. Alas! That all my efforts could only give the Emperor a few weeks more liberty, since he surrendered upon the 15th of July to the English. But it was not my fault that he was not able to collect the forces still waiting for him in France, and to fight another Waterloo with a happier ending. Had others been as loyal as I was, the history of the world might have been changed. The Emperor would have preserved his throne, and such a soldier as I would not have been left to spend his life in planting cabbages, or to while away his old age telling stories in a café. You ask me about the fate of Stein and the Prussian horsemen. Of the three who dropped upon the way, I know nothing. One you will remember that I killed. There remained five, three of whom were cut down by my hussars, who, for the instant, were under the impression that it was indeed the Emperor whom they were defending. Stein was taken, slightly wounded, and so was one of the Uhlans. The truth was not told to them, for we thought it best that no news, or false news, should get about as to where the Emperor was, so that Count Stein still believed that he was within a few yards of making that tremendous capture. "You may well love and honor your Emperor," said he, "for such a horseman and such a swordsman I have never seen." He could not understand why the young colonel of hussars laughed so heartily at his words, but he has learned since. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.